Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
There's a reoccurring dream that a surprising number of people share, and it usually goes something like this. You're walking down a familiar hallway, maybe at a high school, maybe college, and suddenly it hits you like a ton of bricks. There's an exam today you completely forgot about, or an assignment that's due. Or maybe you realized you haven't been to a certain class all semester. You don't have your notes. You can't even find the classroom. It's often referred to as the forgotten responsibility dream, and in a recent survey, nearly 40% of adults said they'd had some version of it. That fear, the fear of realizing you've forgotten something important, is nearly universal. And what if that terror didn't come from something you'd forgotten to do, but for something you forgot you'd already done? But in 2010, for one man in Atlanta, Georgia, that fear became real. It was an ordinary day until police showed up at his door. They said his name. They said there was a warrant. They told him they had the right man. And yet, as the handcuffs went on, he couldn't think of a single reason why, which left him with one terrifying thought. What could I possibly be forgetting? Join me now as we examine the murder of Janai Coleman, a teacher and mother who was gunned down in a shopping mall parking lot. You'll hear how detectives spent 2 years chasing a case that always seemed just out of reach, and how one piece of DNA gave them what looked like an ironclad case, until a twist so strange, it felt more like a dream than real life. It was February 3, 2010, in Atlanta, Georgia. 51-year-old Donald Smith was doing what he did every Wednesday, collecting his mail from one of the city's homeless shelters. For years, Donald had been living a transient life. As a convicted felon, steady work and stable housing was nearly impossible to hold on to. His record read like a long list of bad decisions. A federal bank robbery, armed robbery, drug offenses. But he'd served his time, and now he was simply trying to get by, one day at a time. What Donald didn't know was that as he was collecting his mail, law enforcement had been watching the shelter all morning, waiting for him to appear. As soon as he stepped outside, he was surrounded by officers, cuffed, and taken straight to police headquarters.
Gotta read your Miranda, okay, before we can talk. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say cannot be used against you in court of law. You have the right to talk to him. Do you understand you see these rights, sir?
Yes, I do.
Okay, having these rights, do you want to discuss it and I can explain this to you?
Yeah, I would like you to explain to me why I'm here.
Okay.
In the room with Donald was Detective Damian Cruz and his partner, Detective Edward Restrepo. And from their perspective, they were staring at a suspect they believed they had dead to rights. But Donald's mind was racing. Had he done something he didn't remember?
Your name came up and you popped up on his investigation. Obviously, checking up on you. We check all aspects of the people we're looking at.
Well, whatever it is, man, I just hope that I was in jail at the time. What legacy I'm
letting you? He'll let you know the times and dates and all that.
The detectives already knew he wasn't in jail at the time of the crime. They'd been on this case for 18 months. They knew every detail. To them, Donald was guilty. They were simply waiting to see how he'd respond.
Okay, it's about this vehicle, okay? I'm gonna ask you questions. Have you ever seen this vehicle before or been in it?
No, I have not. What kind of car am I looking at here?
It's a Dodge Stratus.
No, I haven't.
Never been in this car?
Never.
Okay. Never driven or been in it? A friend of yours or anybody like that has this car?
No, I've not been in any kind of car lately other than my parents. That's it. I've not been in that car. I've not seen that car. No.
It's like a bronze or gold.
Never been in it, man.
Donald was baffled. He hadn't seen that car in his life. But the detectives pressed on and showed him another photo.
Have you ever met this woman before in your life?
The picture showed a middle-aged African-American woman. Donald studied it carefully, searching for any flicker of recognition.
No, I haven't.
Okay. Have you seen her ever?
No.
Through a friend or relative or anybody?
I have never seen this woman before.
Okay.
Ever. I don't know her.
Donald admitted he didn't know what this was about and wondered aloud whether he should even keep talking.
Forensic Files is an absolutely best show.
Okay.
But I happened to watch 48 Hours yesterday. I don't like 48 Hours. But these two, the two episodes that they showed yesterday, which was in the 48 Hours, was about two guys that were arrested for murder.
Okay.
They actually did.
Okay.
And there was open this interrogation room just like this. And that's interestingly enough.
Okay.
And but both of them had actually committed the crimes. And they had, like, forensic evidence that associated them with that particular crime.
Sure.
And with the way that the detectives were discussing it with them, but they were kind of, like, locked in anyway because of their forensic type situation. But it was just interesting. And I'm saying to myself, man, why don't I just keep this shut up? You know what I mean?
He'll explain everything, I guess, he has in the case and what he's looking at. And guess why your name came up and go from there. And maybe you have a perfectly good explanation for it.
The detectives weren't looking for explanations. They had DNA, they had video, they had cell phone records, and they had witnesses. To them, Donald's denial was just an act. It was time to put the cards on the table.
Obviously, with the young lady, the picture he showed you, the charge against you right now, the accusation against you is murder.
And that was the person that was supposed to be murdered.
No, she is murdered. She is dead.
I'll be glad to have.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Detectives told Donald he'd been arrested for a murder that took place in July 2008. But instead of panic or outrage, Donald looked relieved.
I was a little scared when he first, I was like, I don't know, what the hell is this about?
Sure.
Then when he said murder, like, that was almost laughable.
Okay.
That was a relief, actually. Oh my God, it was a relief.
I hope everything works out for you. I mean, if, that's the case.
I was going to, definitely. Truth prevails. It's a little stressful still.
Well, being in legal issues or police, I'm sure it's, nerve-wracking. I'm like, I've been a cop a while, and if I get pulled over, it still makes me a little nervous. That's just when the way things go.
This is my first time being in a situation like this, even being accused of something like that.
Okay.
That's what makes it laughable for me. I mean, I'm not laughing.
I understand.
But that's the relief of it all. Like, I know it's not me, so I'm not even tripping.
Okay.
Not only did he seem relieved, any hesitation about talking vanished.
I'm not apprehensive about this at all. I was really shocked with the way it came down, that way they rushed up on me. But when he told me it was this, I was relieved. Actually, to tell you the truth,
sure,
we wouldn't even be having this conversation had it not been for this case you're talking about. Because this is just totally beyond me. I have no problem discussing this.
You've been straight, I guess, since the issues you had years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Because that's how you can hook me up to a machine. I don't believe in the machines, but okay. I know I had nothing to do with like this, and I don't want that woman. I wouldn't mind knowing her.
Okay.
I absolutely don't believe this is happening to me.
If Donald was acting, this was one of the best performances the detectives had ever seen. But the evidence told another story. So the investigators laid it all out for Donald, explaining exactly why he'd been the one who'd been arrested and was now sitting inside the interrogation room a year and a half after the murder. The murder had taken place in the Atlanta suburb of Duluth, Georgia, on July 18, 2008. 40-year-old elementary school teacher Janai Coleman was sitting in the driver's seat of her gold Dodge Stratus. It was around 9 p.m., and she was parked at the far end of the Gwinnett Place Mall parking lot. Janai was a single mother, waiting to give one of her daughters a ride home after a shift at Red Lobster. That end of the parking lot is where Janai always liked to park while she waited. The bus station nearby offered free Wi-Fi, and that evening, she used the connection to join an online Bible study with other members of her church. Her window had been down, and suddenly, without warning, a man approached her car with a gun. He went straight to her window, shouting and cursing. He opened the door, pointed the weapon at her, and pulled the trigger.
We at Gwinnett Mall, and the lady just got shot.
We're at Gwinnett Place Mall.
We're at where the bus station's at.
Okay, can you see her? Where'd she get shot at?
She's on a tree, laying down.
Is she breathing, conscious and alert?
Yeah, she's moving a little.
Okay, what part of her body did she get shot at?
I don't know. We're looking at her unless you want me to come walk by her.
Did you see where the person is that did it?
Yeah, he was in a car, but he pulled off. It was like a beige car.
And which way did he go?
He went like back through the drive, the parking lot up in Gwinnett Mall.
Okay, is he white, black, Hispanic? Were you able to tell?
I think he was, I don't know. Like the girl, she African American. I mean, like
okay.
She's. And the dude, I mean, might be black.
Where is she bleeding from?
On her side, it looked like.
On her side, like her, like.
Oh, like on her stomach.
On her stomach, okay.
A police officer came.
He's there now?
Yes.
Okay.
It only took a minute for the first officer to arrive at the scene, who discovered Janai laying face down on the ground. She had a single gunshot wound to the left side of her chest. An autopsy would later reveal that the bullet had torn through her lung, diaphragm, and stomach. Although paramedics raced Janai to the nearest hospital, hours later, she was pronounced dead. Detective Cruz was called to the scene to investigate. The very same detective who'd be sitting across from Donald Smith a year and a half later. With very little to go on, Detective Cruz began speaking with potential eyewitnesses. Several people had heard the gunshot, but only one had seen what had happened. A city bus driver. She told police she'd seen the entire thing, start to finish, and described the shooter as a black middle-aged man about 6 feet tall, wearing a green and white shirt. According to her, after firing the gun, the man yanked Janai from the car and slid into the driver's seat. Janai cried out for help as she collapsed to the ground. The killer paused for a few seconds before calmly driving away in Janai's car. At that point, Detective Cruz was weighing two possibilities. One, this was random, a carjacking gone wrong, wrong place, wrong time. Or two, this was personal, something domestic. The bus driver said the man had been screaming at Janai, hurling profanities before he pulled the trigger. His rage wasn't the kind that came out of nowhere. It felt pointed, deliberate, like he knew her. But by this point, authorities still didn't know who the victim was. Janai had arrived at the hospital unresponsive. No ID, no phone, no purse. Whatever she'd been carrying was likely still with the shooter inside her car. So while Detective Cruz worked to piece together what had happened, they were still missing the most basic piece to the puzzle, her name. But that changed around 3 a.m. when a woman named Camila Coleman called police to report her sister missing. At 40 years old, Janai dedicated her life to serving others. She was a Navy reservist, fresh out of training to become a military police officer. But her heart had always belonged in the classroom. Her true passion was educating children. As an elementary school teacher, Janai was loved by both students and colleagues, and she was making concrete plans to open up her own preschool in the near future. Long before that, Janai had become a mother, adopting three daughters from the foster care system and raising them on her own. By every account, she lived for her children, her students, and for the people around her. When Detective Cruz began asking questions, friends and family all said the same thing. There wasn't a single person in Janai's life who would ever want to harm her. The only name that came up at all wasn't someone connected to her directly. It was her daughter Felicia's ex-boyfriend, a man named Patrick White, the father of Janai's infant granddaughter. It turned out, Janai had gone to Patrick's house the day of the murder to drop off the baby.
You're the father of Felicia's child, is that correct? Okay, and his name is Justin, your son?
Yes.
Okay. And how old's Justin?
3 months.
3 months? Okay. Would you see her once a week, twice a week,
or maybe 2 or 3 times a week?
Detective Cruz wanted to know if there'd been any tension between Patrick and Janai.
I never had any problems with her or anything like that.
Okay, and do you know of anybody who did?
I wouldn't even guess anyone would have a problem with her, really.
Okay, what was her personality?
She wasn't mean, she wasn't strict, or as far as I know, she was a down-to-earth person.
Patrick had nothing but kind words for Janai, but Cruz still needed to confirm his alibi.
Friday the 18th, did you happen to see her that day at all?
I think it was in the daytime I seen her. She was dropping off my son to me at my mom's house.
She drops Justin off with you. Can you remember what she was wearing by chance?
A short sleeve white shirt that she was like behind the car.
Okay.
Felicia told me that her mom didn't want me to see her because her hair was crazy.
So you never even said hello to her?
Just a wave. That was it.
So it's you, Felicia, your parents at the house. Mm-hmm. What was the rest of your evening like?
What did I do? I was just at my mom's house the rest of the night. And then Felicia, I think she went to her friend's house.
So she leaves and then you're at your house with your parents. Who else is home?
It's actually just my mom, my little brother, and my sister.
Did you leave the house at all that night?
At about 11 or 12, I went out with a friend of mine. And then I came back the next day.
Patrick's story checked out. His mother and siblings confirmed he'd been at home that night and hadn't been anywhere near the mall where Janai was killed. Still, detectives asked if he knew anyone else Janai might have been seeing.
Did she ever mention maybe any boyfriends or any friends that she would hang out with and spend time with?
She hasn't mentioned anybody, but Felicia told me she had a friend she was talking to that she met in the Navy.
Okay.
I think his name was Joel. So that's the only person that she's told me she's talked to.
Detectives learned Janai had a potential love interest in the Navy, a man named Joel Ubera. And when detectives reached out, Joel also said nothing but good things about Janai. As for his alibi, he was on a naval base in Japan. Bit by bit, the picture came into focus. Everyone Janai had been close to, her family, her friends, her students, spoke of her the same way. She was kind, grounded, selfless, and no one in her life had a reason to do harm to her. Which meant, Janai's murder hadn't been about revenge, jealousy, or anger. It was beginning to look like the hardest kind of crime to solve, one with no clear motive at all, just a random, senseless act of violence that shattered a family's world. Janai's family gave detectives the VIN number for a missing car, and it didn't take long to track it down. The next day, her vehicle was found abandoned in a shopping plaza, 40 minutes away, in the suburb of Forest Park. At first glance, the car looked untouched. No broken windows, no obvious damage. But when detectives searched the interior, they found something that didn't belong. Beneath the driver's seat was a single cigarette butt. The rest of the car was spotless, almost too clean. And Janai didn't smoke. She didn't let anyone smoke in her car either. So the cigarette stood out, like a clue left behind by mistake. Detectives believed it might hold DNA from the person who killed her. They sent it off to a state crime lab for testing. But there was a problem. The lab was facing a massive backlog, and results could take 6 months, a year, maybe longer. Having no solid leads and lab results still months away, Detective Cruz continued working the case and turned to surveillance footage next. He spent hours combing through footage from businesses near the crime scene, frame by frame, angle by angle, and eventually, his patience paid off. At a Quick Trip gas station just blocks from the bus stop where Janai was murdered, he found something. Roughly 2 hours before the shooting, a man entered the store. He matched the witness description: black male, white shirt with green sleeves, carrying a duffel bag, talking on a cell phone. The video quality was grainy and faces were hard to make out, but the audio was clear, and Detective Cruz could hear the man ask the clerk for a pack of Bronson Light Longs, the same brand of cigarette found under the driver's seat of Chennai's car. Then, in footage pulled from Forest Park, the same area where the stolen car had been left, Cruz spotted the man again. Same clothes, same duffel bag, walking away from Chennai's vehicle. There was no longer any question. This was the man who killed her. Police then released the surveillance video to the public, sharing it to local businesses and news outlets, hoping someone, anyone, might recognize him. But no one did. For now, the man's identity would remain a complete mystery. For 13 long months, the case went cold. No new leads, no new sightings, just silence. But on August 6th, 2009, that silence broke when Detective Cruz got a call from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. The DNA results from the cigarette were finally in, and the profile belonged to someone already in the system, a man with a long history of violent offenses and weapons charges, Donald Eugene Smith, current whereabouts unknown. Detective Cruz pulled Donald's mugshot and compared it to the Quick Stop footage, and the resemblance was unmistakable. Digging into Donald's background, Cruz learned he'd recently worked at a local seafood restaurant. When he showed Donald's former co-workers the gas station footage, every single one of them confirmed it was him. From there, the case began to take shape fast. On Donald's old job application, Cruz found a phone number. He cross-checked it against cell tower logs, and the results were stunning. Donald's phone had pinged at Gwinnett Place Mall the night Janai was murdered. Then, roughly 40 minutes later, it pinged again in Forest Park, right where her car had been abandoned. It all lined up. The video, the DNA, the cell data. It was as close to airtight as a case could get. Now, they just needed to find him. That's when a former co-worker gave a crucial lead. He told investigators that Donald had been picking up mail every Wednesday from a transitional housing facility across town. So on February 3rd, 2010, Detective Cruz and his team were there, waiting. And this time, Donald Smith didn't walk away. Back in the interrogation room, the detectives laid it all out. The DNA, the surveillance, the cell tower data. Piece by piece, the case against Donald Smith was becoming undeniable.
That vehicle you said you've never seen before?
Mm-hmm.
And the woman you've never seen before?
Yes.
Okay. Your DNA ended up in that car.
That's interesting, because my DNA couldn't have been in that car because I've never been in that car.
Okay, well, I'm just explaining to you how we get to this point, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Your DNA was found in this lady's car, and I was doing an investigation on the person the DNA came back to. Then we come back to you, he started investigating you.
Exactly.
That's when he got the application, just to verify some things, we find out where your mail goes, to that type of thing. And that's how he came up with you.
Oh, why, Lord, have mercy, oh, goodness gracious.
Detectives then showed Donald the footage from the Quick Stop gas station, waiting to see how he'd respond.
So with this guy right here?
Yeah. You're saying that's not you?
That is definitely not me. I don't have a shirt like that. I don't care to see the face on that person, but that's not me.
Okay, so that's not you?
No, definitely not me.
That's not you? Okay.
It's not me. I take a lot of attention, man.
But you don't recognize the guy in the store, and you're saying it's not yourself, correct?
That's not you.
On the video, okay, it looks a lot like you, okay? I showed it to several people, and they identified you. Let me explain. They identified that individual as being you, okay?
Okay, but now this is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you showed it to some individual and they were identified as being me, I don't have any friends.
Okay.
I don't have any friends out here. I don't know who could have identified that as me because it's not me.
Despite the overwhelming evidence, Donald denied everything. That wasn't him on the video. That wasn't his DNA. And according to him, that wasn't even his phone. But the detectives kept on pressing.
This is, I guess, the application for them for new employment. Do you remember all this information, providing it to them? You want me to read it to you? Just so you can hear it and see if it jogs your memory as far as accurate information?
I mean, I'm looking at it. I can see that this is my handwriting. I did file an application for them. I worked for them.
Okay. In here, it lists some phone numbers.
It was not mine. That was my brother's phone number.
Okay, well, obviously, they had it as you listed it for a contact number as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
I didn't have a phone then.
No.
It wasn't working then.
Okay.
But your brother never actually gave you his phone, so you can just borrow it?
Shit. No.
Okay. Basically, there was an incident that occurred near that bus stop, okay? And that's what we're investigating. The phone number, okay, that you listed as a contact number, okay, was in communication in that store at the time that person's in the video. Make sense?
Okay, it makes all the sense in the world.
Okay.
To detectives, it was clear. Donald was dancing around the facts, making excuses, trying to stay one step ahead of what he already knew was coming. That's not me. That's not my phone. You've got the wrong guy. So they asked if he'd take a polygraph.
Now, when I refuse this test, you gonna go ahead and book me and take me where you take me to?
Right now you are under arrest, and you know, whether you wanna take it or not, yeah, you both in. We gotta probable cause. Obviously shows that you were there. It shows that you did it based on what we got now, okay? Now, if you want to take a polygraph, that's fine. And if you don't want to take it, that's fine also. Okay. I'm just trying to be as fair as I can to you. Okay.
I mean, I would kind of really like to take that test. I've never taken one. And I don't mind, but...
I understand. I understand. I'm all right. But if you still want to do it, she's still downstairs. That's up to you.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay. All right, Donald.
Donald agreed to the polygraph. And he failed badly. Especially when asked if he recognized the man in the surveillance footage. Even as the truth closed in around him, Donald Smith kept denying everything. Incredibly, almost unbelievably, Donald actually did have an explanation.
You said this, you talked to some people and they said that was me. These people didn't tell you that was a possibility that could have been somebody else? That looked like me, like my twin? They didn't tell you that? Is that it was me? Did they know I have a twin? Did you know I have a twin? It's not me. It's not my watch. Not my phone. Those aren't the numbers I call. They're the people I know. I don't know the girl. Never seen her.
Whatever relief Donald might have felt earlier was gone. Now it was heartbreak. Because the man in the surveillance video, the one matching the DNA... The one seen leaving Janai's car wasn't him. It was his identical twin brother.
Twins? Like born at the same time or identified as that?
Like born at the same time, like identical twins, yeah.
Okay. And what's your brother's name, sir?
Ronald. Donald Ronald.
Unlike fraternal twins, identical twins share the same DNA. And in this case, only Donald had a criminal record. Only his DNA was in the system.
if your brother did something that stupid, you need to go ahead and just educate yourself in the whole situation. You've had your issues and you've got your problems with life itself. And if your brother did something that silly or that stupid, you need to be like, I love him, he's my brother. But it's obvious that you wouldn't condone that type of behavior. So you just need to step aside. I mean, you can't support your brother on something like that.
No, and you're definitely right. You're right. I don't think I need counseling on that. This is a difficult moment.
I understand.
The detectives were stunned. But the more they thought about it, the more everything started to make sense. The DNA, the phone number, Donald's reaction to being arrested, his confusion, his denial, his devastation, all of it fit.
Well, it could only be one other explanation, because if I've never known the young lady, never seen her, never been in a vehicle, there would have to be somebody who shares my DNA. Honestly, that's disheartening.
Okay.
I mean, it really is, but
if it's somebody shared DNA, then it will have to be either you or your brother.
Obviously. Now, in light of this polygraph, I have no reservations about taking that whatsoever. The lady says that it's showing deception.
Okay.
I know that I was extremely nervous, and when she was asking me the questions, the only thing I kept seeing was my brother doing something like that. It's devastating, actually. But when you showed me the video, and I seen it, I see everything about him. That's his watch. And anyone that we know, mother and father, was to see that same video, anybody that we know, would know that that's him and not me. Not only by demeanor, but certainly by dress. I don't wear clothes like he wears clothes. That's the one thing that does differentiate us.
By now, the detectives were inclined to believe him, but they needed confirmation, proof that the man on tape was Ronald.
I'm telling you, they're the people that knows us best, and that's mother and dad, and they're both still living and functional, would know who that is in that video.
Okay, is there anybody else?
Everybody else in my family.
Okay.
Do you think he'll step up, or do you think he'll let you take the fall?
All comes down to the come down. I think he'll take it. I think he'll step up.
Following Donald's lead, detectives showed the surveillance footage to his family, including his sister.
You know how computers are. Just give me 1 second to pop this
up. Go ahead.
One of them is going to enter here. There's three different screenshots, and they get a little better as they go. They say one of your brothers is going to enter here. He's going to kind of walk to the side. And then there's one, a shot where he's standing right in front of the counter, and you'd be able to see a little bit better.
Like a white shirt with like short green sleeves.
When he comes up to the counter, I could put the volume on.
It's my brother Ronald. I want your cards and stuff.
Okay. How do you know it's Ronald?
They're my brothers.
Well, that's true. I can never tell twins apart. Ever.
Yeah. They're different. They're very different.
But you felt that that was Donald? Ronald.
Ronald.
Just by mannerisms and stuff? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not going to take any more for now. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you.
One by one, Ronald's sister, mother, and father all identified the man on the video as Ronald. After taking Ronald into custody and seeing the brothers side by side, it was easy to see how the surveillance footage alone could never tell them apart. Fortunately, detectives found another way to tell the difference. Although identical twins share DNA, they don't share fingerprints, and crime scene technicians were able to lift one clean print from the driver's side door of Janai's car. And guess what? It matched Ronald's.
The fingerprints have come back, okay? And the fingerprints are a match. So for us to discuss the matters of the fingerprints and the other things, I have to advise you guys. Okay? You have the right to remain silent. Anything you can say will be issued against in a court of law.
At first, Ronald denied having anything to do with the crime, but his body told a different story. He looked shaken, lost.
This is the woman, okay? Her name was Janai. She had three adopted children. who's a school teacher. Her family begged me just to find out what happened. They begged me. And they're very religious people. And they were more just wanted to know why than anger. And they stressed that to me. Okay? Her cousin's a deacon. They're from another state. She had 3 little adopted children. Okay? They just wanted to know why. And I promised them I would at least ask. I told them I thought it was an accident. I'll be honest with you. I mean, am I right in accidental?
I can't swear. I just can't say.
Okay. Will you let me know? Okay? Please? Because I made them a promise. I will try to just know why. They don't even care about anything else, but just understand what happened and why.
And your response has been, I'm not confessing. I'm not ready to confess to anything right now. I'm not confessing to anything. Even though you know you were there, we could put you there. And we have this overwhelming scientific evidence to do that.
Well, I'm going to say something. I really do.
Just say it.
I really do. I just can't bring myself.
Eventually, Ronald asked for a cigarette break, and that's when Detective Restrepo saw Ronald light up a Bronson Light Long, the same brand found in Janai's car. When Ronald returned to the interrogation room, he sat down, paused, and finally spoke one word.
Guilty.
It was the moment detectives had waited 18 months to hear.
It was an accident. Great accident. It was a hair trigger. Whew. It was a hair trigger. And it was an accident.
Okay.
Still an accident. And I didn't drag her out of the car.
Different witnesses see things differently, especially when they hear something.
I did not drag the woman out of the car, period. I wouldn't care what anyone say. I did not do that.
Right.
I didn't mean for the gun to go off in the first place.
You're just trying to get a car.
She got out the car. And she said, help. And I was getting in the car. And she said, help again. Only lighter this time. And I drove off. The woman didn't deserve this. I had no intention on doing that. It went off. Shot the shit out of me. Because it wasn't drastic. And the only way I would really hurt somebody is someone trying to hurt me.
Ronald confessed to accidentally shooting Janai during a carjacking using a .357 revolver. With his confession, Donald was released from custody, but the case wasn't over, because soon after, Ronald changed his story. Despite his confession, when Ronald was formally charged with felony murder, he pleaded not guilty. At trial in 2012, his defense team made a last-ditch effort to shift the blame back to Donald. They claimed Ronald had confessed only to protect his brother because Donald had a longer rap sheet. They argued that the fingerprints on the car didn't prove anything, that Ronald had simply helped clean up after the fact. But the jury wasn't buying it. After a 5-day trial, deliberations lasted just 2 hours. The verdict, guilty on all counts. Ronald Smith was sentenced to life in prison, plus 25 years. Under Georgia law, that makes him eligible for parole after 30. He'll be 84. In the aftermath of the trial, something remarkable happened. Janai's mother, Dr. Geraldine Brown, approached Ronald's mother to offer her condolences. You lost a son, and I lost a daughter. It was an extraordinary act of grace from a woman who had every reason to be consumed by bitterness. But perhaps the most powerful tribute to Janai's legacy came in July of 2015, when her family opened the Janai Excellence Academy, the preschool she'd always dreamed of building. By the 7th anniversary of her death, more than 100 children were enrolled. Janai's dream, to give kids the strongest start possible, was finally becoming a reality. Though Janai didn't have a choice in how her life ended, everything she chose along the way tells us who she was living her life in service to others. Her final evening was spent in Bible study, waiting to pick up her daughter. She adopted and raised three children who needed a home. She devoted her life to children's education, and she served her country in uniform. None of it for attention, none of it for praise, just quiet, steady choices made by someone who understood that a life well lived is measured not in by what we take, but by what we give. Her brother Edwin, who was inspired by Janai to become a minister, put it simply, she stood for what was right. She stood for encouragement and for improving the lives of young people. And today, Janai's legacy continues. A legacy no one can ever take away. And now I'd like to introduce the podcast, Broken, the Black Dahlia Murder.
Her name was Elizabeth Short, but the world would come to know her by another name.
The Black Dahlia.
The Black Dahlia.
The Black Dahlia.
The Black Dahlia. In 1947, her body was found severed in a vacant lot in Los Angeles. The headlines were sensational, the rumors endless. But who was the real woman behind the myth? How did Elizabeth's life lead her to become one of the most infamous murder victims in history? And the question that still haunts us nearly 80 years later, who killed her? Join me for my new 6-part series of Once Upon a Crime, Broken, the Black Dahlia Murder. I'll peel back the layers of truth and legend to uncover the real Black Dahlia and provide details lost to history in this chilling case. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, or watch on YouTube.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @MadnessPod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.